Welcome to the Rethink Sales Podcast. I'm Mark DiNullo.
And I'm Michelle Seeker.
And we're talking about transformation delusion. Why do we expect big results and repeat the same old patterns? And how do we change that for our lives and our businesses? And we're picking up in this episode with part two of our conversation with Roland Zelis.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the customer side. And so what's really interesting for me is, like, you know, how did you approach them? How did that go, right? So how did you decide to go out to your clients, your customers? What was the messaging like? I know that there were concessions made along the way, but just reaction and what you did.
We didn't run into this one and it was a surprise. I think it was the most funny roundtable I had, which was with a set of CIOs, German CIOs at that time. And they were like, as long as I'm in my job, we will never have a cloud application in place.
Oh, interesting.
Which was like, oh. And then, you know, you start the whole conversation about why actually having a kind of own computing center isn't so safe. But anyway, I think, wow. You know, and then you can imagine we have lots of large OEMs, automotive companies who claim their computing center, their compute power is bigger than any of the cloud competitors, blah, blah, blah. So what people were afraid of wanting going from a perpetual model into a subscription is you create this interdependence. It's a commitment, but it's a commitment from both sides. And helping a customer understand that they actually gain power and they're much more involved in what you do, but they believe they have this one-sided dependency because when you live about like a perpetual license, it's like a product. You buy a product, you own the product. And now you sign to a service. And it took a while where that customers lost their discomfort. I think some of the customers, especially in the world we came from, always with engineers and makers and products, people have a product thinking. So they did not yet make, at that time, didn't make the transition from, I build a machine or I build a car, I sell it, and that's it. But, you know, there's service with that. Later on, you find things like, you know, I think Tesla was great. They changed more even on the automotive. But I think a lot of the customers suddenly thought about, oh, I built one product, and then customers can sign up to a service. And in winter, they have steering wheel heating. In summer, they have seat heating and seat cooling, and then heating in winter. So that actually how you can move into a service contract with your customers, predictive maintenance, Internet of Things. I think when you talked about the changes, so we help customers how they can change their own business model. And customers who started to progressively think about that one then also, you know, were more willing to go there. But at the beginning, it was like, oh, okay. You just want more money.
you just isolated me as a customer. So you said something very interesting that I just want to not get lost in the conversation, which is what you knew and what you understood is the customer believed that they were in control, that they had control, and they would lose some of that with that SaaS model. So that's what it is that you were looking to overcome. It was more of a thinking than, you know, than maybe reality from your position. So I think that's an interesting thing, is understanding, like, what is it that's important to them and then how you address that. Did you end up using like any case studies of customers that were successful to demonstrate to others? Was there anything else you did?
First of all, I think it's a good point. It's like, what is fact and what is fiction? I think this is one effort, I think, training your sales organization and marketing on the communication, how you communicate. So yes, we did that, but what we did at the very beginning, because, you know, we were like, had now example to follow. We did something I appreciated a lot at the time, which was war games. I think it's sometimes the name is sometimes a little tricky and depending on the time and the culture. Before, what we did for each like the big change, but also for any announcements, we always had a group of people together where certain, like a team of 3 to 5 people always, they were playing various competitors. So they become the competitor. Some became groups were customers, some were the industry representatives, and some were the customers. And then, okay, what could be an argument if you are the competitor? What is your counter strategy to that one? How you make it a better business? If you're a customer, you know, how can you destroy that? Why would it be a problem? So, and the more time you spend with that, I think the better your argument become, and also you correct a lot of things, you know, while you get into that one. Because you do that, then you test the story with your customers, you improve it further, and then you go out, and then at least you have a good framework where you can work with. The other thing it did, despite the kind of put yourself in the shoes of a customer, put yourself in the shoes of a competitor, the more you practice it, the better you become in that one. And that also drives on the cultural change I mentioned earlier, that you will be able to challenge without being a disbeliever or being against the change. You challenge because you put yourself in the shoes of a customer, or you act like a competitor. And this helped also building a trust in the organization that, like, okay, from a customer point of view, that's the way it looks like. How can we improve the model? How can we make it more customer friendly?
Yeah, I want to go back to the, and I love the wargaming thing, because it seems like one of those things that a team just wouldn't take the time to do, because that takes, it takes thought, it takes effort. You have to set aside time to actually do that when you're kind of like running and trying to make the business grow. But I think that's a very thoughtful approach. With the revenue, and I wanted to get back to this question of how you were growing. You had to get to this 5 million customers in just 5 years, when it took 30 years to get to 1 million customers. And we talked about that briefly before. But my question is very simple. How did you actually do that? Because when we look at your quarterly, year-over-year quarterly revenue growth trend, which you shared with me last time we talked, it looked like from maybe it was late 2015 through almost 2018, you had negative year-over-year quarterly revenue growth, right? And so how did you actually get there when you're kind of going into this trench like you did?
Yes. Yeah. I think this was one of the scary parts in the sales organization and also in the finance community, as you can imagine, because I mean, it's profits and cash flow. And it goes to the point earlier, what is fact and what is fiction? So when I look back, I think what happened all the time is because of the industry and the widespread of our technology, we very often became a reference point for pricing in the market. And at least in the volume market. And then this goes back to the history of Autodesk, where we started like 80% of the functionality for 20% of the price. So we drove a lot of, that's kind of how Autodesk came into the volume. Over time, actually it was more than 100% of the value, but still for 20% of the price. What we completely underestimated in that market was cloud and the change of the business model. And I give you, maybe I briefly talk about that one. The first one is when we moved from a perpetual model to the subscription model, we changed the pricing from whatever the, so let's assume the perpetual price was 100, the subscription seat now was 40. So in going down so much on the price and having a very competitive offer already, it really helped us to go gangbusters on adding new customers and seats. And not having experienced it, nobody could even foresee it or see it. So I think this is going to the fact and fiction. Yeah. I think you can dream of it, but actually then it happens. And the second part is cloud. With, if you come from a traditional company, we didn't know what it means. And there was We had some offerings in the cloud, but I think this is what typical mistake you do as a company coming from one business model. You just copy what you did before and do the same thing in the cloud. And this doesn't create this exceptional growth. We were lucky in one area, which was the construction business. This was the boom of infrastructure. I think we're still in the middle of that. And I think the whole construction industry is growing incredibly. And the whole industry really didn't change a lot from the technology. I was always making fun of like construction companies. They were great. They did build pyramids like long time ago, but unfortunately they didn't really improve technology overall a lot. And they really jumped into adopting new technology. And one of the slogans I used at that time was like moving the workers on a construction site from having a gloves and a shovel to an iPad.
Wow.
And if you imagine everybody running around at a construction site, moving from a tool to a technology, you can imagine how many more users you have. And that's why it turned out reaching the 5 million wasn't actually the biggest challenge.
Wow.
On the revenue side, same thing. You had to sell significantly more to get to the same revenue. That's why we knew, and this was planned, we had 1 year of declining revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And the quarters were going a little bit up and down because when you announce something, then you have a lot of customers buying early and, you know, all these kind of dynamics. But it was 1 year actually where we were burning a lot of the cash. And then from that time on, when you look at the charts on revenue or the quarters, it looks like a straight line going up. And this is then proof of revenue, quarterly results, and cash flow.
So what did that mean for you had your activist investors, obviously they understood, but what did that mean for the investment community at large? How tolerant were they of that? And did they understand the message?
I can quote our former CEO. He said like, okay, the people who believe they stay or invest more. The ones who don't believe, they go. And you have to go through this transition where, you know, you have kind of long-term investors and short-term investors. The short-term who need short-term results will go away, and they replace a lot of them into long-term investment investors. For them, it turned out very well because when we started, I think share price was probably $28 to $40, some up and down, and now it's like in the 300 range.
Mm-hmm.
I think it worked well. The activist is. At that time, this was when Carl Bass, I think, was there. So when they understood what we did and we did the announcements, when the share price was going up, then they walked away, made probably double their investment. I think in hindsight, they probably will regret it because they would have stayed for long term. They probably would have another 5x. Benefit, but it's a game. No, but it's not so different. I think the long-term investors understood this is a good model if we're able to execute. I think that's always, this was always the big thing. When our CFO explained it, we had this famous chart. It was a golden snake showing, okay, like it was a flat line and it was going down when you burn through cash and then this line going straight up to the right. And it turned out to be true, but nobody knew for sure at that time.
Yeah, and that's exactly what your revenue curve looked like. Yeah, it dipped down, and then it accelerated above where it had ever been before. And I think you're also pointing out the difference between investors and traders, right? So the investors actually understand that message and that story, and the traders are going to get out and probably create opportunities for others.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one more question, question on the customer side. And then I want to ask.
By the way, it's also great for employees, I think. Don't forget that. I think it's a great thing. I think a lot of the companies have that, the stock programs and also incentives you give to the employees. They benefit from the hard work big time.
Yeah, precisely. Great point. On the customer side, I just want to ask one more question on the customer side. So you talked about the difference in price they saw. You talked about, you know, their ability to probably get to, you know, more different offers this way as well. But one of the things we look at in this transformation delusion idea is one of the tricky points is you're solving the wrong problem, right? And you might say, well, we want to go to a subscription model, and here's why. It's going to create better revenue streams for us, whatever that might be. But when you go to the customer, and they kind of, like you said, they have their own point of view, like we're never going to go to a model in the cloud, right? What is it that you're telling them that you're solving for them? Because they don't really care about your subscription model for you. It's like, what are you doing for me that's better? And it's maybe it's not just price, but did you see that there was a difference in what you were solving for them than maybe you thought it was initially? Or maybe you knew from the beginning what the customer problem was you were trying to solve.
The great thing about that time, Carl was a technologist and kind of on the development side, a product person. He didn't, you know, of course, as a CEO, you're responsible for revenue and product and profits, but this was not his number one priority. I think the biggest thing was for us, we're having this portfolio of 175 products, as I mentioned earlier. You can grow it to 500, but how will a customer deal with that? So we start like, how will the original start was, how will our customers work in 10 years or 20 years? How will technology help them? And this is still true. I think the idea we had is, okay, you make the products disappear and customers really consume capabilities you have and the ones they need at the right time. The only way to do that is on a platform. And, you know, you only get to a platform and cloud, I think you have to move to a SaaS model. So that was the original start, was really, okay, you see the divergence of the industry, you move to a platform, customers can consume whatever they need at the point in time, and then a little bit of a pay-per-use model. And that's where we started. And then later on, of course, I think the financials came in. Okay, how you make that work and how does it work in a subscription model? So this was the second thought. So we always had this vision of, okay, this is how it's going to work and why it's a better world for the customers.
Mm-hmm. But the customer, like you said, in the construction industry, they may not have evolved their thinking to the level that you have, right? So you're saying this is how you're going to work in the future. And they're like, really? Okay. So did you have to carry them along and to paint that vision?
For the industries, I think the more difficult one was manufacturing.
Okay.
The construction was more easy because there were a lot of studies around at that time, like Stanford constantly every year they published that productivity of a worker in the construction industry was actually declining on a year over year over year over year basis. So there was this pressure. If you look to the balance sheets of construction companies, the profitability is not very high. I think the return of capital employed is good, but not the profitability. So from a business point, I think it was more easy to argue. Uh-huh. And as I mentioned earlier, they're moving workers from a gloves and shovel into an iPad user. And it's just a simple example. Is what happens at a construction site is every day somebody has to control whether, you know, the security, the fences are still okay. You have all this quality and safety regulations. So somebody walks around and fills in papers every day in the morning and every day in the evening. And then on a Friday, this goes to whoever is leading the construction site. They had to type it all in and put it on a computer, rather than do it real time, you know, with an iPad and a punch list, and you just do it and then the work is done. So the ROI was just crazily high. I think they saved a day per week per person.
Wow.
So it wasn't very difficult on that side. And then all the other things came along. Manufacturing was a bit more and I think what helped is because there's no IP. Okay, in construction, if you have a building, every building is a prototype. You don't have a mass production, and how you produce something isn't really a secret, okay? So the industry was sending things around in email, Dropbox, and whatever storage they could find, and sharing documents. So nobody was really afraid of the internet and the openness of it. So that's why I think the adoption went fast. There was just no technology because it wasn't an attractive market, because the company's profitability was low. So nobody really provided a lot of technology because these companies weren't very high on the investment side. Just to make it, to demonstrate you the challenge, the only, if you look all industries and investment in IT, construction was the second lowest. Only hunting and fishing was investing less in IT.
Wow.
So that's why no technology was available. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg. And I think this change drove a lot.
Yeah, so hunting and fishing, like building fishing lodges and hunting camps and stuff, probably not that. But if you could find a lower cost solution to go into construction, I get it. So with the manufacturing, it was a harder sale. Was it harder to paint the vision for them, or was it because of the IP, or what was it that made IP. It hard?
One thing is, if you produce something 1 million times, 100 million times, or only 10,000 times, the big thing is Six Sigma. Okay, six kind of wrong goods in 1 million produced items. So the kind of quality of the decision and the security of the decision is going a little bit against what we all have talked about with transformation. Like, speed is more important than being 100% sure on the decision. So that's the cultural clash. The second one is IP. I think they're so worried about the IP because if you build something, whether it's a golf club, a desk, a car, whatever, you know, you can think rockets about the most complex goods. The industry we're in the model, what the engineer does, the all IP sits in the model. And for them to think about this is in the cloud, can be cracked, and somebody can steal it, it just drove them crazy. I think it took a while until we were able to explain them, okay, this is re-engineering. You can do a lot of re-engineering. You can find it anyway. And you move your innovation into software. So they become a software and a service company. As I mentioned earlier, I think you have a product and you sell it, and then kind of you sell and forget into, okay, you create a customer relationship, and then actually a lot of the innovation you have is in, and your IP is actually also in software. So then you're also less worried about this part. So this was one of the changes. The other thing is, they were had a high investment in IT. Mm-hmm. So if you today, and this was possible at that time when we did that, you could go on the internet, you order your car, and they can give you the delivery date back. Okay, and everything was already managed through software. There's lots of kind of hundreds of subsystems. And then the systems were coordinating, okay, in 7 months, some company who produces the windshields have to have the windshields at the belt. The imagination, what can go wrong when you touch any of the systems, just drove people crazy. And that's kind of slowed down the willingness to make changes, because they never thought about this one. But nobody disagreed that they have to move. They just weren't agreeing, okay, why should I be first? Find somebody else who goes first. I'm worried. And I think it was a surprise, because at the beginning I would have expected the people who are very tech savvy, which was manufacturing, would immediately understand it, while construction would take a long time. And it actually turned out to be the opposite, because the non-techies were like, that helps me a lot, while the technology savvy people were like, were worried about the changes they had to do.
So I want to talk about the sales organization. You've got direct sales and a reseller channel. And we know that it's a two-part question. The first one is, I know that you faced some friction, and there were some changes that needed to take place. You mentioned, for example, the growth of inside sales. So I wanted to first just talk a little bit about, you know, what needed to change with the model, and were there things maybe you didn't expect? And then I'll follow that up with an incentive conversation, because okay, that's really important. So
this was, as it drove a lot of the churn on the employees, is we knew, or we were convinced, okay, we need inside sales. So I did, you know, we did build up from, we had no inside sales at all, okay, because I told you I'm an engineer, and a lot of our people, our employees were engineers, and an engineer sells to an engineer, and you cannot have a non-tech person sell it over the phone. Okay, this was kind of the myth of fact and fiction are different.
Yeah.
So in building up these inside sales teams, I think, you know, I was, for instance, I did Barcelona in Europe. So we moved from like 0 to 500 people.
Wow.
And you start at the beginning, and then I think you figure out actually it's not so different. And we knew it. So which went along with the change of the sales organization. We asked people, you are on the road 3 days a week, and I think all calendars are published. And if people didn't go, you ask why. And then their typical argument was, you know, I was on the phone, which is perfectly fine, but why should I pay somebody, pick a number, $180,000 to be on the phone in the field versus somebody who does the same job for one third of the cost or for a quarter of the cost in an inside sales hub? So we were sure this is going to work. So we started in like a moving of, for instance, I had 12 people every 2 weeks and trained them,
right,
and moved, and then you just add, and then, you know, it becomes a machine. The big difference is you had to move to a standardized sales approach and a standardized sales model. So, and then driving a lot of automation, of course, like, you know, with basic things I think everybody's using. And then you learn what works, what doesn't work. Goes back to, okay, you have a script, what works, what doesn't work, based on the customer. And then you start to automate things, then it become better and better and better. So the big thing was really customer. There was a kind of the notion of, okay, I want to talk to an engineer, but I think you want to talk to somebody who is interested that you are more successful. So changing customer expectation and changing also the internal expectation was a big challenge, because the product, for product sales, is very important, because that's the connection to the customer. But the problem is now there wasn't an engineer. So we had manufacturing engineers talking to the manufacturing customers, and then they were talking to the manufacturing product group. So you broke this one. So they had to take over the task of, okay, they connect to the customer, fully understand what customers want, how they need it. So you don't have the sales team in the middle of becoming your Sherpa, trying to find out what makes sense or not. Sales is here to sell. And of course, we provide you customer feedback and customer experience and make all of these things, but we're not like you're helping you to create your development roadmap. I think that was, for the product team, one of the big, so which I think they had to figure out, okay, how to do that. On the inside, it turned out very fast. I think success is always like when you have 12 people every 2 weeks, and then success kind of proves that you're right. And, you know, you always have the chance to slow down or accelerate when you see your assumptions were wrong. I think the biggest challenge was then that technology. Your technology team wasn't set up, because if you have a field sales organization, they're able to figure it out themselves. Now you have a machine, so suddenly your internal IT department is not set up. Okay, telephone system, you need somebody who is constantly changing, optimizing, Salesforce, tools, everything. So you had to hire a whole armada of IT people who help you to keep the machine running and go faster and faster. Because I mean, we didn't have a lot of time to reach to the 5 million.
Wow.
Customers.
And what did you guys do in terms of incentives? How did that change?
So the tricky one, the internal wasn't so difficult because you can always align incentive plans with what you want as a company. In simple terms, if I mentioned a perpetual license was 100 and the subscription was 40.
Yeah.
So we just planned and make things equal. So I think for the salespeople, it didn't make a difference. And then after the first introduction, which was in the middle of the year, you overweight on the subscription and make sure they do the right thing and the money will help them to get the right incentive. So that was simple. The tricky one was the channel.
Yeah.
Because the partners is a cash flow business. And when you have your kind of snake, golden snake, and you burn into cash and actually negative, we lost money.
Yeah.
I think it was the first and only time in the history of the company that we lost money. The partners are in the same boat, but they don't know whether this all works out and whether all your great stories are true.
Mm-hmm.
So helping them to not kind of cut half of the organization out and making the change there. So what we did is, and you know, it was a tricky one, also for the finance community, is we made the change in the middle of the year. The reason for that was, I think, when we spoke with partners and you had to trust them that nothing leaks out, that they knew they have time to build cash flow and create a buffer to go with us. And then also, if you split it up on 2.5 years, it makes it a little bit more challenging for us as a company, because ideally you want everything in now, and then from that minute it goes up. If you are a partner, you want it as slow as possible. And what we did is we did it in the change in the middle of the year, so they could build a cash advance, we're burning into it, and then in the year after, when after 12 months typically that was the toughest one, then it started to grow, so they could get there, and then you had payment, cash incentives. So we did a lot of these things because this was one of the biggest worries I had at that time, because Autodesk's 85% of the business was indirect through resellers.
Oh, wow.
We were worried that we would wipe out our partners just going bankrupt. So, you know, lucky, I think it all worked well. I think partners were trusting us, and it also made it easier in the future. You know, we just, before I retired, we moved from a reseller model by sell into an agency model. And luckily, because of the great experience, partners actually were believing. I think it was probably more scary than this one, what we did with them. But I think we got them through, and I think that's all very successful business. But that was tricky. Internal is easy. In my opinion, the internal one is more easy because it's a large company, you have enough money, you control a lot of the changes. The external is difficult because it's very programmatized and you have a lead time, and also there's less tolerance for getting things wrong because you impact a lot of other companies. I think at that time we had 1,500 partner companies.
Wow.
And, you know, and more than 10,000 salespeople. So I think you impact a lot of people with the wrong decisions. So.
Did you lose any significant portion of your partner network during the transition?
No, it grew. We also, I think it looked very different afterwards, because what was clear, and I think we constantly were talking about acquisitions, size matters on that one, to become larger and being a larger partner. So we incented mergers and acquisitions with partners. So, you know, a long time ago, but I think when I started, I think we hardly, as a company, we hardly had a $100,000 deal. Now, you know, nobody's blinking when you do a $25 million deal. I think $100 million, okay, that makes the press. Same as partner. If you had $1 million revenue with us, I think you were a hero partner. I think they were invited, you know, this was a great thing. And nowadays, I think, you know, I cannot talk about that, but it's half a billion is a good partner.
Yeah, the numbers have changed.
And they acquired. I think we didn't lose anybody, and we told everybody who's like, okay, I cannot survive with this one. I cannot even make the year, that they sold the business. And our contractual framework helped a bit because customers were always ours. So nobody could sell the business to somebody without our consent. So we got a lot of partners becoming very large, which helped us also on the Servit platform. If you think about that, you want large companies who can actually help customers globally.
So winding up, looking back on this big transformation, Roland, if you could have done one thing differently, looking back on it, is there one thing you would have done differently? What would it have been?
Go faster and be more bold.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Okay.
It's nobody knows the outcome. What the outcome would be different. My only comparison would be Adobe. Mm-hmm. Adobe more or less jumped into it overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the market position, I assume they had the belief, okay, they will lose some customers, but majority will go with them. And it was forced. Customers were forced. They had to make a decision, okay, yes or no. We communicated a lot with customers, and the customers who had a maintenance contract got a price protection for 10 years. I don't know whether, you know, anybody in the software industry would give a commitment for 10 years.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we did.
Wow.
Customers were still worried, but I think they also understood, okay, we committed. In hindsight, I think that's why I say, I think being more bold, because nobody makes a change fast. And I think, but it's a pure mathematical, okay? If you say, I don't care about the money, then this is not so important. I think you could still be more bold on some of the changes and go faster and bigger. It's always, what did Mark Zuckerberg once said? Is that like, people overestimate what they can achieve in 1 or 2 years and underestimate what they're able to do in 10 years. And the same is true on these kind of changes. You kind of over-concerned on the short term. And I think there's no need to be so nervous. I think that's why I say be more bold and go faster.
So if you were sitting down with an executive now over coffee or a drink, and they said, Roland, we're going to go through a major transformation. From what you've learned, what two or three pieces of advice would you give them?
On what I just said, I think we did, by the way, we moved very fast on the move from a buy-sell model into an agency. This was done within 12 months.
Wow.
And I think it's a lot has to do with culture of the company. I think it's strange because a lot of companies, you think about the revenue, the profit, the customers, etc. I believe one of the most important things you have to manage as a company is really culture. And the one advice I would give is become an experimentation machine. You know, not like crazy expert, but I think something which drives the change, like, okay, you have this kind of umbrella vision, mission, where you go, and then you go and go and go. And that's why I say you change and you change the change and you change the change. You constantly change, and you do lots. Sometimes you do experiments where you're trying to find out things, and otherwise you just course correct. And it's much more like a meander route rather than a straight line, because there is no straight line. And I think it's, you just have to constantly know where you go. And don't be afraid of things not working out. You just have more information. You learn something. You also sometimes learn what's not working, and then you know better how things work.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, Roland, thank you very much. Where can people follow you or follow your work with what you're doing now?
I think the best place is LinkedIn.
Okay.
On LinkedIn, Roland Zealous, I think. I'm the only zealous Roland on this, on LinkedIn. It's easy to find.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us. Thank you for helping us kind of think through or rethink transformation and what it means to be successful. I think these have been great words of advice, great stories.
Yep.
And we learned a lot of new things here. So thank you very much, Roland.
Yeah. And the biggest thing, go faster and be bold.
Thanks for joining us. And remember, Sales Globe is a revenue growth consulting and services firm focused on helping our clients reach their revenue growth aspirations through better solution development and operationalizing to get results.